Hello, and welcome to Civility and Solutions, a podcast brought to you by your Court Services section of the Supreme Court of Ohio. I am your host, longtime justice enthusiast, Kate Munger. This is a podcast about inspirational ideas for courts from across our 88 beautiful Ohio counties. Today's topic relates to elder maltreatment. Elder maltreatment is a devastating societal problem that hurts older victims and their loved ones and negatively impacts the community. We'll talk about adult protective services and how courts can solve problems of elder maltreatment without resorting to guardianships. The views expressed by guests to this podcast don't necessarily express the views of the Supreme Court. We are happy to be able to use this platform to share solutions and challenges with courts and any listeners who want to stay on the cutting edge of dispute resolution and court services issues. Welcome to Season 1, Episode 14. Our topic is Combating Elder Maltreatment Through Adult Protective Services, Laws, and Legal Interventions. Joining me today are two people with caring hearts towards our elderly population, Sylvia Plath-Raith and April Worley. Welcome to the podcast.
Good morning.
We appreciate you inviting us.
Sylvia Plath-Raith serves as the director of the Attorney General's Elder Abuse Unit, where she promotes policies and educational initiatives to increase positive outcomes for victims of elder abuse, neglect, and exploitation. What initiative is your team working on right now that you're excited about?
Well, that's one of the things that the Elder Justice Unit does is work to help support. In Ohio, we have a very fragmented elder abuse system. So one of the things that we do a lot is support local counties. So one of the things we work closely our counties on APS is really trying to bring together adult protective service workers, the legal team, and representatives from probate court on how to maximize the use of protective service orders, which we're going to be talking about today. And I'm glad you brought it up because it is an alternative to guardianship. And I know many of us strive to protect older adults, but we also want to honor and respect their autonomy. So I think I'm really excited that you're having us here today because we're going to be able to talk a little bit about Ohio APS, but also this, not every court does protective service orders. So April and I are on a mission to get to 88 counties to make sure that their APS and court systems are maximizing and using court orders. So we really do appreciate this time, Kate.
Absolutely. I want to give all this information to the courts so that they can, make good choices. They have options out there. Sylvia, before you started at the AG's office, you worked for 10 years for Cuyahoga County Adult Protective Services. What was the nature of your work there?
So Cuyahoga is probably or is the largest county in Ohio, and it did have the largest and still does have the largest adult protective service system. So I was there for 10 years as their chief supervisor. So I oversaw, I don't think that position exists in any other county. I had a full unit design for intake for APS, and we had APS investigators, over 25. I think they still have 25 workers. And then I supervised five supervisors at overseen. So I did that for 10 years, and I learned a lot because prior to that, I was what I would refer to as a mandated reporter, which I think April's going to talk more about. I feel like I have a good perception on what it's like to be a mandated reporter. I thought that I knew what elder abuse was from that side, but I really learned more when I became the chief supervisor and actually was overseeing the unit. And that's good insight for me when I do talks like this, because I think I feel like I see both perspective. Now in my current job, I'm an advocate. So I'm advocating for victims and not systems. So, which is, because I understand both sides of it, we're able to focus on how can we best help the victim. Really requires professionals to compromise and look at the different systems, where are the gaps. So it just gives me a unique perspective.
Absolutely. And Sylvia also has a Master of Arts degree in Health and Human Services from John Carroll University and a Bachelor of Science in Psychology from the Ohio State University. And in 2017, Sylvia was awarded the Advocate of the Year Award by the Ohio Association of Area Agencies on Aging. Very alliterative title. So glad to have you here, Sylvia.
Thank you. That just means I like to talk. As you'll find out.
Next, I'd like to say hello to April Worley. Okay, so full disclosure, April and I go way back. April was an outstanding caseworker for the Delaware County Department of Job and Family Services, investing child welfare cases, while I was assistant prosecuting attorney. And if I recall, April, testifying in court was your favorite part of the job?
I think it was mine and your favorite. I'm sure you loved when I had to testify because I was an absolute nervous wreck. And every time, and Kate would always say to me, I don't know why you're so nervous. You do fine once you get on the stand. But I do remember one time when you took away a pen, because I used to take a pen up there to click while I was testifying. And I remember you taking that away from me. And you said, you cannot take any pens or pencils up there anymore, because I was clicking it while I was testifying.
Oh, I'm sorry. I took away your comfort pen.
You did.
Oh my gosh. These were the
but
joys.
It worked. She went ahead and testified and didn't need it. So you did a good job, actually.
Yeah. I did not like testifying at all.
Well, the work was the important thing. And April and I also filed in probate court for matters dealing with elders, and April advanced at Delaware County and became the Adult Protective Services Supervisor. And I think we were like kind of pioneers in Delaware County for probate filings for adults.
We were the one and only to date. Well, at the time, I don't know about now, but we were the one and only team to file a guardianship in Delaware County Probate Court through an Adult Protective Services case.
It was definitely the first, because after
it was.
I ended up with a bunch more, but we started it. We had to figure it all out.
I remember you and I sitting down at your computer and looking over all the rules and regulations and like, what in the world are we, what do we do? How do we proceed? It was definitely a learning experience. And I remember the court saying it was the first and only they'd had at that point. And the woman was heartbreaking. It was very sad.
And April, I know we were so sad when you left Delaware, but very excited for your new opportunity. What are you doing at the AG's office and what kinds of projects are you working on?
So I work under Sylvia. She is my supervisor. So I also work in the Elder Justice Unit at the Attorney General's office. I am the lead senior services coordinator, and I work on similar but different things than Sylvia. I'm involved with some projects right now having to do with interviewing victims. Also, we have some potential upcoming conferences this spring and this summer that we're excited, hopefully, to be able to do some training. And one of the recent things that I've done is I always do volunteer training for SARNCO insane nurses. And we talk about sexual abuse and older adults and domestic violence. So those are some of the things that I'm working on currently.
Well, great. It sounds like they're keeping you busy over there. And
Sylvia was going to say something.
Well, I wanted to say that because I think April needs to let us that you know that our unit is very small. We only have 3 people, and it was created in 2014 with the specific reason to address this fragmented system that I was telling you about. If you're a victim and you're being victimized by elder abuse, there's lots of different systems that can help you. So sometimes victims get lost because if they call the wrong one, and the other one doesn't necessarily do a good job getting them connected. So the folks that are calling our office are typically folks who have tried to get help and haven't, whether it's through the police system, whether it's through probate, whether it's through APS. So what we try to do is connect the dots. The other big part that we do is outreach. So we do a lot of education, because one of the things that we wanted to do initially with this program was to increase the prosecution of holding the bad actors accountable, is that victims weren't coming forward. So a lot of what we do is to talk to, like today, is to get victims to come forward themselves, people who work with victims to understand that this is a situation that requires either APS or law enforcement. And then the other part is teaching folks what to do then, because like I said, there's so many complexities when you're working with adults. And so it does keep us busy, but we are just 3 people. And so Monica Walker is the intake. So she gathers the facts. And then April kind of assist with either mediating if the worker needs, because we get a lot of calls from APS workers who don't necessarily have a good trained supervisor. So we fill a void for a lot of professionals are calling us because they really don't know what to do. It could be an APS, it could be an attorney. We get calls from a lot of different folks who are just trying to get some guidance of what would be the best for that particular case. So we use the metaphor a little bit that we're navigators, and we navigate folks through this elder justice maze. And you can just call us as a consult. It doesn't even, you know, sometimes we don't even have a name of a client. I know we had one recently with Lorain County, for instance. We have a case that we're trying to connect law enforcement and APS. So we, you know, so that's what we do, is to try to get the locals to understand and then help them, because we don't have any jurisdiction, which is in some ways bad, because I can't tell people what to do. And I'm kind of used to that. When I was at APS, I had all kinds of authority that I could use and exercise. And now I can't. Now we're leveraging the relationships of the office and our knowledge to get folks to listen to us, host that meeting, mediate. But at the end of the day, if they don't want to listen to us, they don't have to. So that's what we don't like. It's when we, like, you know, Ohio has a local home rule state. So it's frustrating sometimes when we feel passionately about a case. We want them, the investigator, to keep it open. If the older person dies, we still think it's, you know, but we can't force them. Or we want that prosecutor to consider past the person's consent, ability to consent. So it can get frustrating too. And April's nodding her head now, because I know that we like to see the bad. We like to see the bad guy getting caught. We're not going to lie. We both share
agreed.
That passion.
Yeah. Agreed.
So, It's frustrating when we realize, okay, we did what we could with the tools that we have, and we have to accept that that's just what it is. So it does keep us busy, because if that happens, we'll try again on the next case. So our goal is to win over every ADA county and to try to make sure that we're protecting as many victims as possible.
And I also have said many of times in this job, I wish I knew half of the stuff I did that I know now when I was back in as an APS worker and supervisor, because there was just so much I didn't know. And so I enjoy teaching others.
That's great. And Dave Yost, the AD, your boss, everyone's boss over there, was my boss at the right. Delaware County Prosecutor's Office, because he was the chief prosecutor. So we've all come full circle here, April.
I know, right? Delaware County representing.
That's right. All right. Well, friends of this podcast will know that in episode 13, we learned about elder care and coordination. Today, we will address an alternative dispute resolution option for cases involving elders. All right, Sylvia and April, are you ready to get started?
I think so.
Yes.
All right. Well, April, let's start with a little background information. When we are talking about elder abuse, what does that mean?
So in Ohio, there are now, this is every state's different, so I'll just start off that way. But in Ohio, we have different categories. We have physical abuse, which obviously broken bones, bruises, but that can also be, you know, restraining to a bed, restraining to a wheelchair, things of that nature. We have emotional abuse, which is verbal, threatening, could also come into play in a domestic violent relationship. Something that I feel like people don't think about is, you know, if you're in a domestic violence relationship for a long time, it doesn't just stop when you turn 60, right? It just doesn't go away. That violence can definitely continue to occur as people get older. So we also have sexual abuse, which can be anywhere from photography to assault to touching and everything in between. And we have financial exploitation, which we're going to talk more about, I'm sure, because that's the one that is the fastest growing. And so we will talk more about that later. And then we have neglect by others, which is when there is a caretaker and they're not providing for the older adult. We have abandonment, which was recently added in 2018. Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. 2018. That's what I thought. So if you're a caretaker and you decide to go on a cruise and don't make any arrangements for your mom, and she sits there all week and doesn't eat any food, then that would be in an abandonment case. And then we have self-neglect, which is actually the most common reported. And that is, you'll see typically like a lot of hoarding situations, or people refusing to take their medications. But overall, statistically, only one in 24 cases are ever even reported. So we know, and that's forever, that's for the whole country. So we know that elder abuse maltreatment is significantly not reported. So those numbers, even though they're growing, are still very low to what's actually happening.
And I'm sure there are folks listening to this podcast who may never be involved in an elder-related court case, mm-hmm. but I think it's important for everyone to be aware of some red flags for elder abuse so that they can keep an eye on their elderly friends and neighbors and clients. Can you mention a few things that could be signs of elder abuse?
Yes. Yeah, so that could be a very long list that could take all day. So just know that. And every situation is different. So there's different things to look for, but some major things to look for is changes. So, you know, if you have an older neighbor that is always clean and put together and goes to eat brunch every Sunday morning at 10 o'clock at the same spot, and all of a sudden you see over time they're losing weight, they're not showering, their house is getting really dirty. So changes like that. Also paying attention to all of a sudden, you know, there's a new friend, that was in air quotes, a new friend or a new family member that maybe starts coming around to the older adult or moves in, or starts taking over some of the financial things that the person had been taking care of themselves is always something to look for. Anything else that you can think of, Sylvia? Any really big ones?
Well, I mean, I think you hit the real big ones. I think what's interesting about this stuff is it is very insidious. We usually use the expression that it happens behind closed doors, and you can't always see it. And that's what makes it challenging, like for, because April mentioned neglect. One of these things about these allegations is that they typically happen together. So in an exploitation case, for instance, it's very typical for the person to use either emotional abuse to control the victim or neglect to control the victim. So I remember I had a very famous case when I was in Cuyahoga. She was an epileptic and he was intentionally withholding her Dilantin because that would make her have seizures. So while she was having seizures, she would be confused, and that was how he had access to her finances. So the smart perpetrators, and I can call them other stuff, but I know we got to keep this clean. The bad actors will typically use ways to control their victim. And it makes it hard for us to notice that something's going on. Because I had staff when I was in Cuyahoga as a chief supervisor. If they walked in the case, if the person was clean, the house was clean, and it smelled good, and everything's in order, they'd be like, oh, there's nothing going on over here. And it's like, well, this is where these financial abuse cases are hard, is because you're not always going to see it. So sometimes you have to follow, I think April and I use the term spidey sense. You've got to follow a sense of this, something about this doesn't look right. So what I'm going to encourage your readers is, or your listeners, is that it's... sometimes you just got to follow that gut to make that phone call. And I'd rather have people err on the side of making the call, because I think, April, you said one in 24 cases get called in.
And I was just going to explain kind of why the numbers are like that.
Okay. I'll let you explain this. I'll stop. I'm just going to say that you hit it on the mark, but I know overall, I'll leave it with this. We have an underreported problem. So most of us, even professionals, you know, we kind of talk ourselves out of it because older adults, and I guess I'll let April explain that more, but it's really important for us to call versus not calling, because the reality is we already know for a fact, and in Ohio is no different than any other state. We have more elder abuse occurring than we realize, but we tend to talk ourselves out of it. So sounds like April wants to tell you why. So I'm gonna let her do that so I don't take away her thunder.
I hope you don't mind. I might be skipping to the next question, Kate, but I wanted to talk about why they're so underreported, or what some of the reasons why. And for victims, one of the things that I always talk to people about is the threat of a nursing home, right? Is such a really powerful threat. So if I'm a perpetrator, Kate, and you're my grandma, and I want to keep taking your money, and I'm stealing from you and abusing you, if I say to you, if you tell anybody, I'm going to throw you in a nursing home, and you know that he probably could, that I probably could, that's a real threat that would, that'll keep victims from talking. On top of the fact that we do have older adults, the only person they see in their lives are their perpetrators. Mm-hmm. The only people that are visiting or taking care of them is their perpetrators. So that is also, even if they wanted to tell someone, how did they do that? You know, so there's a lot of reasons why they're not called in for professionals. I think a lot of it is what Sylvia said. They talk themselves out of it. Oh, I don't know enough, so I'm not going to make that call. Or I don't want to say it's this person if I don't know for sure. And we're going to talk about that later with mandated reporting, but I wanted to bring that up.
Well,
sorry to skip ahead.
It's okay. There's no skipping ahead. We're just having a conversation. So when you mentioned earlier that the fastest growing form of elder abuse, neglect, and exploitation is financial. So can mm-hmm. you say what you mean by that, and maybe what some common things that you see elders exposed to are?
Well, one point I want to make, so exploitation actually can be of a person or of finances. So don't forget that human trafficking or trafficking a person, money muling, that kind of stuff, it's not always that typical financial exploitation that can fall under that. So financial exploitation is a whole day training, as Sylvia would tell you. So this is putting it in very short terms, but it's really when someone is using an older adult's money, assets, taking, using, could be against their will, could be quote unquote, them willing to do that. And we can talk about that later, but some of the things to look for that we see, I often look at the auditor's website for like house deeds, wills, estates. So if things are changing rapidly, you know, if your grandma had your mom in the will, and then all of a sudden a new best friend comes about and grandma's now giving everything over to this new best friend that she's known for 2 months, you know, things like that to look at, power of attorneys, things changing.
So when you say things changing, you're talking about like a new power of attorney, a new will.
A new will, house, different deed, trust, things changing in that type of situation. Also, when we're talking about exploitation, we also have to talk about scams and mm-hmm. how those are similar and those are different. So we know that scamming older adults is a huge, huge issue. I think I want to say the last CDC report was $3.1 billion a year or scammed, exploited out of older adults in America. So it's a huge amount of money. And it does get complicated when you're talking about an older adult who gets scammed or gets continuously scammed. So one of the things that I always point out is, so if a victim is scammed one time, the scammers will actually sell their information to other scammers for a lot of money. They call it the sucker list, blacklist. And so if you've been scammed once, they're going to continue to try to scam you with different scams because they know, because they're selling your information to other scammers.
So nefarious.
So I know it's big money.
It's big money and it's easy money.
True.
Can you tell us, I'm going to pretend I'm going to take Kate's job from her. Can you tell us, because I know with the pandemic, this has become even a bigger problem. Can you tell us what are the more common scams that are occurring right now?
Yeah. So some of the ones that we see a lot of, well, COVID scams. So, I mean, we know that scammers they play on people's fears. They play on people's isolation and loneliness and their emotions. So, you know, scammers took the opportunity with COVID and the pandemic to really use people's fear and anxiety against them to try to sell them, you know, cures or masks or all of these different things because people were panicking, especially when it first happened. So COVID scams were definitely a huge issue, as well as with the stimulus money that came through. There was a lot of scamming and issues with stimulus checks. One of the other ones that we see a lot is romance scams, which I find these to be the most interesting because a perpetrator will literally look for an obituary, you know, and see that you've been married for 50 years and your spouse just died and you're they're thinking like, oh, that's a really good victim. You know, they're going to be completely heartbroken. They're going through grief. I should probably step up and be their new best friend. But in the midst, I'm thinking about how I can take all their money. But romance scams over Facebook. I had a woman in Franklin County that was engaged to a man over Facebook for 9 years. She had this relationship with him for 9 years, and she had given him over $1 million. She ended up being completely homeless because she'd given all of her money to him. Wow. And when I had talked to her, when she finally called us and I had talked to her and explained to her, like, you have to stop giving him money, please, please, please. So she had told him the next time he had called, and he started threatening that he was going to kill her. He was going to come there and kill her if she didn't continue to provide money for him. In romance scams, you'll see a lot of overseas, like they're overseas, quote unquote, in the armed forces or working on an oil rig, those kinds of things. So I find romance scams completely interesting because it's a lot of emotional abuse and influence that kind of mixes in with that as well. And then the grandparent scam is another large one where people will call an older adult in the middle of the night and say, hey, I have your granddaughter here. She's been in a car accident. I'm her attorney and we need money for her surgery or something like that. And they will get people to send money or gift cards to help their grandkids. So one thing I like to point out is if you put on Facebook check-ins of where you're going. So if I say I'm going on a trip to Mexico and I put all these pictures and I check in, someone on Facebook can see that and can call your grandparents and say, hey, your granddaughter April is in Mexico. She just got arrested for a bar fight and we need money to bail her out. You know, that makes it much easier for the older adult to be like, oh, I do know she's in Mexico. And so I know that's true. So just be cautious. And I think those are probably the top scams, Sylvia.
Those are the top scams. What I'd like to add is why they become a bigger problem a little bit more than, because obviously the pandemic, people are more isolated. People that normally would have been connected by going to the senior center or being with family were separated. So we actually created a whole new set of victims for our bad actors. But the one thing I wanted to point out, it is easy money, because I think that in the wealth of America, people over 55 own the majority of the wealth in America. So the scammers are very intelligent about who they're going after. And it's not necessarily capacity, because everybody associates limited capacity with being a victim. And what we wanted to point out, and April said, she pointed out isolation is probably the number one risk factor, is being alone. So it's not necessarily whether you have capacity or not, because I've seen, and we have seen many people with capacity being taken advantage of because they're isolated. And then human beings are social people. We need to be connected. And so romance games skyrocketed during the pandemic because people were being offered, you know, a chance to have a relationship with someone. So it's, once it's going on though, and this is what we're going to talk about a little bit more with you, is that scams are exploitation. So it is the highest growing form of abuse because it encompasses just not what APS considers to be an exploitation case, but also what's financial exploitation. We call it a hybrid, is when you have both. There's usually a relationship with the individual. It's a family member, but they're, what's really fast are the folks that it's the only thing that's going on because the bad guy is actually in another country. They don't know them. There's not a relationship. They actually created and developed one. So what Ape and I will tell you is that the victims have the same qualities and vulnerabilities, and they use the same tactics. It's just whether it's a stranger, but that impacts who has authority to investigate. How do you stop it? And we get asked a lot to get involved in those cases because some of our adult protective service programs will not consider a scam within their authority. And we're going to explain that to you. And so, until all the money's gone, because now the money's gone and they can't pay for their house, they can't pay for the mortgage, they can't pay for their medication. So now it becomes an APS case. So one of the things that we like to do and teach, because you asked us earlier about initiatives, is first of all, these scam cases potentially may not meet Adult Protective Services definition of exploitation, but they certainly can fall under self-neglect. I personally think one of the reasons Ohio has so many high cases of self-neglect is because it's the one category you fit it in. If you can't, if it doesn't fit under emotional abuse or physical abuse, where do you put it? Well, you put it in self-neglect because you have someone who's demonstrating a high risk. They're not taking care of themselves or putting themselves at risk. It just plops in that category. And those cases are dangerous because if I can't take care of myself and I'm not taking care of myself well, I become a victim for somebody else to take advantage of me. So these allegations commingle all the time. What I'm hoping, and I know you'll give everyone our contact information, is we're going to educate some folks and realize, hey, maybe that was a case I should have called in, or in the future they will, because by us talking about this, I have a feeling people are listening to us, are thinking of these situations where like, wow, I wonder if that was a case of elder abuse or financial abuse that I should have called someone.
Right. So I tell people all the time, if you don't know what to do and you're struggling and you're like, should I call, should I not call? Please call us and we will direct you. We will give you advice. We will, you know, say, yeah, you should call APS or no, or what have you. So.
All right. Well, thank you for all the background on the abuses that the elders might be facing. And I want to turn the conversation now to talk about the solutions to those. So Okay. When there's a concern that the elder adult is being mistreated or neglected, obviously the police are going to do an investigation, and also Adult Protective Services, who we've talked about, can also do an investigation. And Adult Protective Services is our caseworkers, our social workers, employed by their county agencies, typically, who can do investigations. And I'm sure that there's other investigators, maybe at the AG level too, who can step in for higher level problems as well. But what is the role and responsibility of Adult Protective Services in elder abuse and neglect cases?
So this could also take a long time, but so number one, I will say Adult Protective Services, APS, as it's called, is not a criminal investigation. It is a civil investigation. And it should be noted that in that sense, an APS case and a law enforcement case can be occurring at the same time, right? Because they're looking at different things, but they're working towards the same goal. But Adult Protective Services, yes, every county, every 88 county will, they run it a little differently. It's not all uniform. We'll say that. And unfortunately, at this point, although we advocate for funding all the time, every county, I'll ask you this question, Kate. How much money do you think every county gets in 1 year from the state for Adult Protective Services, regardless of the size? Because every county gets the same amount of money. Do you know how much money they get in 1 year?
Oh my gosh, just for APS investigation?
Just for APS.
Yes, just for APS.
I couldn't even hazard.
You have to.
$20,000.
No, you totally. $48,000. So that is not enough for even a full-time worker. So there are some counties, aka Delaware County was one of them, where we had half a worker. So you have a worker who's doing children services half the time, and you have a worker, and then on the other half doing APS. So that funding and situation makes things very complicated sometimes as well. Because depending on what county you live in, your resources will vary quite a bit. But Adult Protective Services, you know, their main goal is least restrictive, putting services in the home if possible. So you'll see, you know, referrals made to like senior centers, Meals on Wheels, those types of things to help people stay in their homes, help people be safe. But there are times when obviously that fails or doesn't work. And I know that Sylvia is going to talk about those interventions here in a little bit as to what happens if a victim says they don't want any services. But generally your APS is run out of your county Job and Family Services. And yes, I think that covers most of it.
Well, I think you forgot to say, which is probably important, is that in Ohio, we define an adult as age 60.
Oh, yes,
and,
I did.
And again, that's in every state that's different. It's like in the state of Colorado, it's 70. And we added in our law. So our law was written initially in the early 1980s, and it has had a few revisions. And actually, since 2015, there's been several revisions but we haven't changed how we define an adult. We added that they have to be vulnerable, which is interesting because I think sometimes cases get screened out because the person making the call doesn't know what kind of vulnerabilities the person has. And that gets left out because technically if you're 60 and older, but you are intact and you can take care of yourself, it's your civil duty to take care of yourself. The APS law is really designed to protect people who are vulnerable. And then the other big problem in Ohio, which we're one of four states that remain, three states, it does not have a protection law for 18 to 59. So there's a huge gap there of folks. So those folks, we get a lot of calls with people in that gap because we're trying to figure out how to help them. But it's very limited. April, I'm just going to say this now because it fits in. In 2018, we changed the law. We changed it twice, actually. In 15, we expanded the definition of exploitation to include people who are being tricked and deceived. So it's not just on the consent. It's visible, but it looks on the surface, it looks like it was consensual, but in reality, it's like what April is telling you, they're being intimidated. So intimidation and fear was added. But it had to be a caretaker, which really limited it because the person had to not only be having a relationship with the victim, but they had to be the one taking care of them. In 2018, they expanded the definition to say a person, which I think we have a very broad definition now of exploitation for APS because it's not a caretaker. It's anyone who it's a person, so it's connected to the adult who may be using their funds without their permission. I think that's one of the reasons why you asked earlier why that's growing so much. The allegation of exploitation is because the definition was expanded. And then we also expanded all the mandatory reporters, everyone in the financial industry. And not to pick on you, Kate, but I know some attorneys, because I talk to attorneys all the time, they think they were added in 2018. And I have to say, no, I'm sorry, you were a mandated reporter back in 30 years ago. The real way to get people to make calls is really having this type of conversation and spending time about what are the indicators and when should we call, because just having a law that says you have to doesn't make you make the phone call. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to flip it back to April, because can you explain a little bit about how Ohio's mandatory reporting works and what is the responsibilities of the mandated reporter?
Yeah, so a mandated reporter, if you want, you can find it in the law, but basically it says that at the point when you have suspicion, cause to believe that there is abuse, neglect, exploitation of an older adult, you are required to call and make that call to Job and Family Services, Adult Protective Services. So you just have to have a suspicion. You don't have to investigate. So there's nothing worse than getting a case on your desk when you're APS or CPS and you find out like 17 people have already interviewed your victim before they even called the report in. So as a mandated reporter, no one's asking you to investigate, interview, get documentation, any of that. At the time that you have suspicion or cause to believe is the time that you're supposed to call that in and let the investigators investigate, because that is their job. Your job is to just call it in. Also, as long as you're calling it in good faith, any person that calls in Adult Protective Services case and it turns out not to be true. So if I call in and say Kate's the perpetrator, turns out that it's not true. As long as I do it in good faith, nobody can come back and civilly sue me. Nobody can criminally charge me for it being false. So there is some protection. But if you fail to report as a mandated reporter, you can be charged up to $500. There is a code in the law for that penalty. And one other big thing that I wanted to bring back, APS only has jurisdiction also with people that live in the community. So APS in Ohio does not have jurisdiction to go into nursing homes, assisted living facilities such as that, which is also why Ohio is so complicated, because the jurisdiction is limited in where the person lives.
That keeps us busy.
Yes, it keeps us busy.
April, if you were investigating a case as Adult Protective Services worker, if you were speaking to an elder that you suspected was being exploited, and you had concerns for competency, how does that impact your handling of the case?
Okay.
Good question.
Well, it is a good question, Kate. And I am going to respectfully tell you used the wrong word.
Ooh.
But so that's not actually competency. That's a capacity, I'd say. So competency is a legal word and only the judge judge can make that decision. So when you're having concerns about someone's decision making, that's their capacity. So I know you're always smarter than me, but I had to take the opportunity that time to correct you. So, but I am going to flip it.
You know, I got to use the legal word that I heard in court, but yeah, capacity is different. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. And it's just this is another area that we spend a lot of time on because, you know, adults have the right to say no. And so, because you asked me if we knocked on the door and we suspected someone is saying no to us, this is where I think it fits in with our and how we collaborate and work with probate court. So APS, by definition, has to respect the adult right to self-determine because we're not working with children. So in Ohio and the United States, you know, we assume capacity, we assume competency. So that's why when we work with folks, we always say, when you call in a case to APS, if they ask you the person's competent, don't answer that question because technically they are, unless you know they've been in front of the judge that's been declared incompetent. You know, I might have, like today, I have capacity to talk to you on the phone, but if last night I didn't get enough to sleep and if I woke up sick, I may be incapacitated to participate today. So one of the things we have to teach people is that competent people can actually be facing incapacity related to over medications, under medicated, and these things happen all the time with APS. Your perp might over medicate you or under medicate you. So when we go out to see folks, first of all, they have the right to not open the door. They have the right not to talk to us. So I may have to respect that right unless I can build a case or have evidence to question whether or not they have capacity issues. Now, that becomes difficult if it's a brand new client, adult, I've never had a history with them. I might have to rely on my collateral contact. Who made the referral? Was it a family member? Was it a professional? I remember I had a big case when I was in Cuyahoga. The perpetrator was abusing the animals and my older adult. She was never home. She wouldn't let us in, and we couldn't get in. So we had approached probate court. Luckily, I love this story because the warden, the animal warden, was able to get in because cats didn't have and the dogs don't have civil rights. They couldn't say, no, you can't come in. But it was very helpful to us because when he went into the home, he saw and witnessed our older adult and the condition of the home. He became very valuable to us because he became our witness. So APS, and it's very specific to APS, they have the ability to petition the court. So it's usually APS should have an attorney like yourself assigned to them because they have to review the case and the evidence. Do we have enough evidence to petition the court? You can get an access order to get in, and you can get a restraining order if someone like a family member, which also happens, they're not allowing APS conduct their investigation. It's being instructed. We can potentially petition the court so we can have that person removed from being, you know, obstructing the investigation. You know, so that's important because sometimes Adult Protective Services isn't able to initiate the investigation. So, you know, April was telling you about people calling in. At that point, it's an allegation. If I accept the case, it's my responsibility. If it's an emergency, I have to go out within 24 hours, or if it's otherwise 3 days to go out and initiate my investigation. I am amazed, to be honest with you, Kate, how many people open their doors to a stranger knocking on the door because it's typically unannounced because we want to catch them in the action, right? I'm amazed how many folks actually open the door and they actually cooperate with APS because some people simply don't know they have a problem until it's brought to their attention. And so the first step of APS is to, you know, be least restrictive and try to work with the adult and engage with them just like any other social worker. You identify your problem. How do you solve the problem? Who do you engage with? Protective service orders are only utilized when that's not working. So it's not the first thing we do. It's usually because you need it. It's a protective service order requires APS to have evidence just like a guardianship case. Because you mentioned you had worked with April on guardianship cases. So I don't have to prove incompetency for a protective service order. I actually have to use the definition of what's considered an incapacitated person. So it's not a permanent status. I'm looking at evidence that suggests this person can't provide for themselves in a particular area. And where I'm talking the most with counties about this issue is financial abuse. So usually in protective service orders, you have to have a case where the investigation, APS has evidence that it's true. It's no longer suspected. We believe this person's being exploited. as well as if we don't take action, and this is the biggest part for protective service orders, if we don't take actions, meaning we don't ask the court to intercede, harm will continue to happen to the individual. So the court order could be used as a temporary way of stopping the malice and putting a protective plan in place to help that situation to make him safe.
All right, so yeah, I got to back up a little bit because you went through a lot, and I think we need to take a step back so people know what you mean by those kind of orders. So, okay, so we have a caseworker from APS, and they've investigated. They have the factors that you found. Right. They decide that this older adult needs some kind of intervention to keep them safe, but they don't want to do it voluntarily.
Right, the individual has refused.
The caseworker can file in probate court to get a guardianship, but you're saying that there's another option, and that is a protective services order. Protective service order?
So
what is that?
So it's specific to adult protective services. So it's an ORC 501.65, and there's three different orders.
Okay.
There's the protective service order, then there's an emergency protective service order, and then there's the ex parte, which is similar to what you did when you were with children, where you suspect it's a life or death situation. I call this a three-legged problem because you need three things. You need APS staff understanding when we want to exercise this, and it's usually around someone who's they have to be refusing. The case has been allegated, but you need someone like you. You need a legal advisor to review the facts. What facts have you discovered? What do we have? What do we need? Do you have it? Do we need to get it from a collateral contact? Do we need to subpoena someone? Like in financial abuse cases, the bank records might have to be subpoenaed. The medical records might have to be subpoenaed. If an agency like Passport's involved, we might need proof that they've been involved and you know what's been going on. So it is very much like a guardianship case in the sense that it's a hearing. Mm-hmm. And then the adult has the right to be present. So the APS law has a lot of provisions in civil rights where the adult has to be told about the hearing. As a matter of fact, they're allowed to be present. They're allowed to talk for them, speak for themselves, but they're also allowed to have legal counsel. So, and if they can't afford one, the court has to appoint one. So there's a lot of checks and balances in the APS law to give the rights to the older adults to make sure that they in fact have rights. But
what does the protective service order do? Like, what does that allow the agency to do?
Your APS has to tell the court what they want. So it's basically giving the court authorizes the protective service plan. So APS not only has to, in this hearing, not only do you have to demonstrate the person needs protection, but what services are needed has to be part of your case. So in this case yesterday that we were discussing, what's critical to this case is whether he truly has capacity or not. He's refusing to go back to the doctor to find out to get the additional testing. So the petition can be around, we need the judge to order that geriatric evaluation to take place. So we can then determine, does he have the right to self-determine? Does he have the right to give his money away? Or does he actually need someone, a decision maker, whether it be a power attorney, because maybe he needs help, but he needs a power attorney, or maybe he does need a guardian. It's because we find out that he needs a financial guardian of estate minimally, because they might have the ability to function of person, but they need some help around the finances. So they're very...
That's kind of an order so that you can complete the investigation that you need to do, so you can get more information.
In that particular scenario, yes, because it's to find out if the person has capacity. Would could be the initial step in the protective service plan. And by the way, in adult protective services, many victims, the easy victims, have a doctor. There's a lot of folks that one of the first thing you're doing in your protective service plan is getting them hooked up with medical care. So a common protective service order plan for an older adult is getting them connected to medical care. And usually, hopefully it's a voluntary process, and many times it is, but sometimes if they're not cooperating with that and there's the facts of the case are they are living in risk. I mean, I've had cases where maybe it was diabetes that wasn't being properly cared for. So the protective service order might need the evaluation to get an evaluation of the medical condition, and then from there begin the plan. So it's
Okay, so that's interesting. So you can kind of get the medical services started that they might need. Can you give some other examples of what a protective services order could have in it? Like, what are some things? Could it be like, get rid of your cats? Or is it like, clean up your house? What are some things that the protective services order could do?
So basically, it's very individualized on the case. So the protective service plan is tied to the original allegation. What is the problem? And so what's the protective plan needed to treat that male, adult male treatment? So if they had cats, and I think we all know we've had cases like April mentioned, hoarding. I know Adult Protective Services sees a lot of hoarding where it might be animal or just excess stuff. So you could, the cleanup can be ordered if we are able to, in court, demonstrate to the judge why we believe, or magistrate, why we believe, you know, what the plan is. Like I said, we have to be prepared. We have to tell them what we want and how we think it's going to help. That's part of the hearing. The judge basically, if they agree with us, they're basically agreeing that we've met the element of the case. We were able to prove that we thought this person's probably incapacitated. We have to prove that, you know, they did not consent to the plan. So we have to ask the people, we have to have show and demonstrate that we try to do it least restrictively. We try to engage with them. How many visits did we make? How many times did we try to get them to work with us, become evidence? And then we have to prove the plan. This is the plan and why the plan would work. If they agree with us, they basically order the plan to be put in place. So there's three different orders. So they're all a little different. What changes in most of them, the general one, the threat is of harm is lower. NAPS can effectively be in the temporary decision maker, legal surrogate for up to a year, because it's 6 months and you can renew it. I used that a lot when I had a complicated case and maybe I didn't have a guardian applicant and maybe they were from out of state because, you know, in Cuyahoga, you know, we had people showing up. They wanted to go to the Cleveland Clinic. So we had folks show up from different parts and, so if you didn't have a residency established, you didn't have an applicant, it's a way of extending the plan and putting it in place until you deal with these complications. And I know APS doesn't like those as much because you can be in charge, you know, a year is a long time to be a surrogate, but you're also allowed to relinquish it or go back to court if you found like, and sometimes family shows up out of nowhere. So I have had clients that after we got the order, I was making the decisions. If a family member showed up and they were someone after meeting them that we thought could become the next decision maker, you're allowed to vacate it. You just have to go back and show there's a family. And then so they're good. They were good for complicated cases. They were good for when you were trying to get someone evaluated because you really did not have a professional evaluation done and you really need it. You need to know whether or not they are making these decisions and they have the right to do so. We would do that. The emergency one is called an emergency, but the hearing takes place between like 3 days. APS has to have their ducks in order pretty good in an emergency because you don't really have a lot of time to subpoena witnesses. So you really kind of have to have all that ahead of time in place. That one's only good for 14 days and then you can renew it for another 14. And then lastly, the ex parte, they're different than guardianship cases in the sense that you're only proving an incapacitated person. They're not being ruled incompetent. It's a temporary status. There are times that you can avoid a guardianship because you're able to put a plan that works in place and the person becomes safe. Sometimes the person then starts cooperating with you, just like a civil commitment after they got help. They realize, okay, I need this help. Or the plan's put in place, but you know, sometimes people, they can't fight it because they don't have the capacity, but they're agreeing with the plan. You could still avoid guardianship because we both know, and actually April, we all know there's people out there walking around, they're incapacitated and don't have a guardian because they're following rules. They're following, you know, they're not in harm's way. So a protective service plan helps in many times avoid a guardianship. And sometimes it does not avoid a guardianship because you find out the person in fact is
needs a guardian. Yeah,
needs a guardian. So you go in that direction. So it's, I offer, you know, in Cuyahoga where I got most of my experiences as an APS, I would say about 20% of our cases ended up in court because it was cases, sometimes we had the case multiple times because like I said, it billed the risk. kept growing. So in the beginning, we didn't have enough information. There wasn't enough to prove. Sometimes you have to let things happen. You can talk about capacity for a very long time because you're really looking at, people need to remember that capacity fluctuates and it could be different and it's specific to the task. So I can't drive a truck, but that doesn't affect my ability to care for myself. In these financial abuse cases that we talk about and we see, people oftentimes have capacity to take care of their person, but they might be experiencing some limitations in their executive functioning. So it's not about memory and their executive functioning that's needed and necessary to execute difficult decisions. And you're not going to find that out in a mini mantle or these little screens that we use. And executive functioning is usually requires some pretty sophisticated testing. And I'm a fan of that, especially when the risks are very high. Somebody one day told me you wanted everybody adjudicated. I'm like, no, I don't. What I want is to find out the truth. By having people evaluated, we can find out what their true functioning is. So we're not making assumptions. But once we find out what's wrong, then we can build a plan that's appropriate with them and not making assumptions. So I do believe in self-determination. I just want to see people. I want to know what people's true functioning is so we can actually deal with facts and not what we believe they need or don't need.
Well, I can see the benefits for using protective services orders over guardianship, at least to start, because guardians in some courts are very hard to come by. They don't have enough lawyer guardians who are going to be appointed, paid for by the commissioners or by whatever money sources the court has. It's expensive. And if you can deal with some of these problems without getting to that step, then why wouldn't we try that? It's a nice middle ground to ensure safety while at the same time not doing the overreach possibly for a guardianship, which in some cases. So Sylvia, let's talk about courts and agencies that might want to start using protective services orders to help elders. What should they do to start? Are there other stakeholders to consider in starting to use protective services orders if they haven't been?
That's great because a judge and the magistrates have a lot of influence. I think if you're a court that you haven't had an APS case brought to you, I would recommend having a meeting with the director of Jobs and Family Services and maybe the APS administrator with the legal. So the prosecutor's office is just as important because it is a three-legged problem. You need all three of those systems working together. If you're missing one, it's probably not going to happen. So if it's not happening, just starting, and I do this a lot, is to call that meeting. Someone, and the judge, as you know, has a lot of influence. If the judge tells you, I'm hosting a meeting and I'm inviting you to come, you're probably going to go, right?
I would, yes.
So it's real important. The probate court has the ability to bring them together. So, and we've done that a lot. And I'm smart enough to know if I go to the judge and have this conversation, they have the authority to ask for that meeting. People are going to show up. And I would specifically want to start at the top with the administrators, because every single county in Ohio is probably dealing with this exploitation epidemic. I think some people are referring it to the crime of the 21st century. This is just another way, if they're not doing them, this is just another way that they might be able to help more people by calling that meeting. Meet with Adult Protective Services, have the legal team to talk about what are they seeing these cases and what are being done to stop it and can they do more? Because by talking, they can probably figure out that if they start exercising protective service orders, it's not going to, they're going to probably end up helping more people. Not everyone. This isn't about helping everyone. This is about helping more people. And I know that a couple counties that we've worked with closely have started doing more of them. What we find is when they have the conversation, they find that we used to do them. Oh, but so-and-so, hey, I remember when so-and-so was here, we used to do them. And what happened is somebody retired, somebody left, a new person wasn't trained properly. And so one of the three legs fell off. So by having that conversation, and then from there, do they need training? Do they, figure out what they need? Typically, you've got to have that discussion so you're all aware Yeah, because if you do a training without that discussion, it doesn't work. Right. You have to have buy-in from the top down. The judge usually has to explain that they want to see these cases, and they need to, and then it's nice to hear the judge explain what they consider to be an incapacitated person, because I've seen sometimes a legal team is using the bar in their head, they're using what's considered incompetent. They're not making that. So it's important for the judge to set the tone. What cases do I want? And, you know, it's really important for the judge to set the tone, because then the others usually follow.
All right. Well, thank you so much. We're nearing the end of the podcast, and there's a bit that I like to do at the end of every podcast, and it's called Two for Me and One for You. So there'll be two questions for you, the presenters, and one question that the presenters will have for the listening audience as kind of a pop quiz to see if they were paying attention today. So I will start with the first question, and I'll direct it to April. April, what's an interesting and relatively brief APS story that you can share?
When I worked at APS, I remember the woman that literally just pulled at my heartstrings because she lived in this apartment alone, and she literally thought her baby dolls were alive. Like, literally, when I would go, she would be like, oh, one of them's crying or one of them's burping. And she had like this whole setup for them. And obviously they were just dolls. And it was so incredibly heartbreaking. She had no other family. She only had these dolls. Like, that was her number one thing in life. And it was just sad. It was so sad. And she was so sweet to me, even though she had no idea who I was. Every time I came, she had no idea. One other interesting one that I had when I was a worker was I learned that you can actually get alcohol-induced dementia. Mm-hmm. I had a case where the woman, she wasn't very old. I want to say maybe mid-60s. And she had full-on dementia, all caused from extreme alcohol abuse throughout her life. And it was just really interesting because I didn't even know that was a thing. And it sure is. And her husband got her a fake, like a dog, stuffed animal dog, because they had a dog and it died and she wanted one so bad. And he was like, there's no way. So she like carried around this little stuffed animal dog with her, and she thought it was alive. But I just learned a lot from that case because I had no idea that you could get dementia
I had no idea either.
Yeah. Right. And her memory span was probably 40 seconds.
Oh, wow.
So yeah, it was very interesting.
All right. Well, I'm going to direct the second question then to Sylvia. Sylvia, who is an amazing person, you know, related to Adult Protective Services, and why do you appreciate them?
I should say you, because April and I make a good team, because I'm the big city slicker and she's from the rural county, and it gives us a good way of dealing with Ohio. But I would be remiss, because one of the persons I worked for when I was a mandatory reporter for 20 years, so I spend most of that time with the older population. So I worked for the AAA. And I also work for Benjamin Rose Institute, which is one of the premier agencies in Ohio that serves older adults. But she's one of the founding members of the APS law. And she was one of my mentors, is Dr. George Annisberger. So I don't know if you, she was very active in when the law was written back in the 80s. But I worked for her at Benjamin Rose. And she hired me when I ran the senior companion program, but she invited me to join the Consortium Against Adult Abuse, which was a group and a coalition that she started. Georgia Annisberger helped me and a lot of other folks. She's a pioneer in elder abuse and domestic violence in older. And if she hasn't been invited to speak, because she still talks, she still works, she's involved at the national level, I would highly
encourage.
She still
comes to our meetings all the time.
Yeah, I would highly encourage that Georgia. She's actually Yeah, she comes to our Elder Abuse Commission meeting. She represents the National Association for Elder Abuse, but I would highly recommend she do a podcast with you. But she would actually be able to talk about Ohio and the changes in the years, because like I said, she was one of the people who founded the APS law back in the 80s. So that was a no-brainer for me to say that.
Aw. All right. Now I'll let you two decide who will ask this question. So give the audience a knowledge check. What's a pop quiz question we should be able to answer after listening to this podcast?
What are two large reasons why victims may not report being abused, neglected, or exploited?
That's a good question.
That's a good one. Yeah, all right. And before we close today, I want anyone in the audience to know how to contact you. So what's the best way for folks to contact the AG's office if they have an APS issue?
Or an elder issue, older adult issue.
Yeah, any elder.
Because even, you know, with facilities and things.
The AG makes it easier for consumers to reach out to us. We have one number that's staff from 7 in the morning to 7 at night, which is a central consumer, the consumer protection.
Yeah, it's 1-800-282-0515. 1-800-282-0515. So that goes to all 30 sections of the AG's office. And you tell them who you need to talk to or what your issue is, and they'll get you to the right appropriate unit. So if you call and say, I have an elder issue or whatever, you'll get sent to us.
Yeah, they get sent. So we get most of the complaints that have to do with older adults. And if it's just a question, so you can ask by us by name. We are working remotely now, but that's why it's the best way to reach us that way. The other plug I want to make real quick is that we have a website that's a subsidiary website that is, it's a great place to get information about consumer issues and scams. It's all one word, ohioprotects.org. ohioprotects.org is a website that's run by our office that has information about what to do about robocalls, what to do about scams, how to file a complaint. There's a couple cute videos in there, but again, there's a ton of information, and it's important because we didn't mention it, and we probably should have. You know, a lot of these older adults don't realize they were victim. So sometimes families, if you show them information about a scam, you can convince them they've been scammed. It makes them a lot easier to work with them if they recognize they're a victim. And so it's very helpful to have that information. It's available on that website. And I think it's helpful in teaching people this is a scam.
One more thing. We do also do events/presentation things with older adults in the community to try to teach them how to keep themselves safe. Obviously, over the last year, it hasn't really been.
It's been virtual.
Yeah, it's been virtual. But prior to COVID, we would go out, nursing homes, community events, things like that, and talk to older adults about, you know, how to keep themselves safe on the internet or what have you, or even just who to call if you need help type of thing.
So we can, if they call the 800 number, they can also be directed to the website. The AG's website has a lot of information because we have over 30 sections. I think it's 33. That's why if you need help getting there, is it okay if I give them my email address, Kate? So it's my name, Sylvia.Plarathe, Plarathe, R-A-I-T as in Tom, H as in Helen, at one word, OhioAttorneyGeneral.gov. But we can get them more information about our outreach. And if anyone has any questions about a case, we're a good resource for them.
All right.
And thank you very much for letting us have this time with you, Kate.
Absolutely. Well, thank you guys both so much. And that's a wrap for today. So much gratitude to April Worley and Sylvia Plarathe for joining us today and for the work that they do to protect vulnerable citizens. And thank you to all of you out there listening. I hope you will join us for the next episode of the Civility and Solutions podcast. Until then, keep working for justice.